thank you everybody again for an exciting and eventful morning that we've had already. I would like to thank also RPM Report, who's a co-sponsor of this event, and encourage you all to take a look at RPM Report. You should have gotten one on your seats today. It's an excellent publication that reports on many issues of interest to you in EBM, including what's happening at CMS and FDA. And now I'd like to also introduce you to Mike McCann, who's the senior editor at RPM. He's going to facilitate the question and answer period for our next speaker, and also introduce Peter.
Great. Well, thank you, Tanisha, and we're thrilled to be a sponsor of this year's conference. And I think it's amazing to look back over the year since the first evidence-based medicine conference from Avalere and think about how much has happened. I think it's a real sign of the maturation of the policy debate that our next speaker is the director of the Congressional Budget Office. Dr. Peter Orszag oversees the office that's responsible for figuring out how much, if anything, any individual piece of legislation is going to cost or save the federal treasury. And the verdict that comes out of CBO can mean an awful lot about what does or does not become law. You have Dr. Orszag's biography in your material, so I'll keep it brief and just say that he took over as director of CBO just this year in January with the new Congress. I think it's fair to say it's been a busy year so far, and I understand it's a particularly busy day with the immigration bill on the floor, so we're very appreciative that Dr. Orszag is here. So without further ado, we look forward to your remarks, and Dr. Peter Orszag.
Thanks, it's a pleasure to be here. I wanted to be brief. I'll speak for maybe 10 minutes or so about why CBO is becoming the Congressional Health Office out of necessity, and then open it up for questions, because I would imagine that that may be the more interesting part of our interaction. So first, you have in front of you a little handout, and I think this first chart is very important to understand, because too much of the public discussion about the nation's long-term fiscal imbalance talks about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in that order. It talks about the baby boomers and aging, and then healthcare in that order. And that gets the relative magnitudes reversed. And so I actually think it's a disservice to the public discussion to phrase things and frame things that way. This first chart shows you what happens to Medicare and the federal share of Medicaid over the next 40 to 50 years. If healthcare costs continue, if the excess cost differential, that is cost per beneficiary minus income per capita each year, continues to grow as rapidly over the next 40 years as it did over the previous 40 years, Medicare and Medicaid will rise from 4.5% of the economy to today to 20% of the economy by 2050, which is the entire size of the federal government today. That top line is why many observers note that the federal government is increasingly basically becoming a health insurance firm that happens to do a variety of other things on the side. The bottom dotted line, now here's the kicker. A lot of people are sort of aware of that top line and the powerful impact of the health programs on the fiscal balance. The bottom dotted line is what many people find more surprising. That shows you what happens if healthcare costs per beneficiary rise at the same rate as income per capita. In other words, excess cost growth goes to zero. It isolates the pure effect of demographics on those two programs. I think you can see that the bottom dotted line does rise, but that where you wind up in 2050 is only slightly higher than where you start today. And furthermore, that the difference on that bottom dotted line between 2050 and today is much less important than in 2050, the difference between the bottom dotted line and the top solid line. In other words, excess cost growth is the single most important factor driving the federal budget over the long term. If I added Social Security to this graph, the bottom dotted line would go up a little bit, but the basic conclusion that by far the most important single factor driving the nation's long-term fiscal imbalance is healthcare cost growth relative to income per capita would remain. Given that fact, I find that the analytical community, the policy community, have woefully underinvested in the types of research that might help you figure out which line the nation will wind up on, or how we can move from the top line to the middle line, or even perhaps below that. As one indication of that, at CBO, let me preface this by saying currently 25% of the federal budget goes to Medicare, Medicaid, veterans health, basically to health care. A much larger share of the growth in the federal budget will be accounted for by health programs. Under 15% of CBO staffers work on health. And I think that imbalance is mirrored both in the public discussion and in the wider analytical community. And it's a disservice to future generations and today's policymakers not to aggressively rectify that imbalance. In other words, we need to be doing a lot more work on what might bend that curve, and we need more people thinking hard about what might bend that curve. In thinking about what might bend the curve, I think it's important to realize that it's not going to be possible just to sort of tamp down physician payment rates or provider update factors in Medicare and Medicaid and think that you're going to then sustain those reductions over long periods of time and solve the problem that way in the absence of broader health care changes. And the reason is that if you're going to continue to provide broad spread access to those programs, you can't just drive down payment rates in those programs by themselves while underlying healthcare cost growth remains unabated and expect access to remain what it is today. So we need to be thinking about changes to Medicare and Medicaid primarily in terms of the way in which they change the overall health system rather than the direct, narrow, within the four corners of the programs themselves impact. And there is hope that changing the programs over those programs are big enough that they can change the way healthcare is practiced. So moving to DRGs in Medicare in the early 1980s shortened hospital stays not just for Medicare patients, but for all patients. And we need to be thinking about changes to Medicare and Medicaid from that perspective. What will a change do to the overall health system? And not think that you can somehow isolate those two programs from the rest of healthcare spending. And that this next chart shows you that over the past 30 or 40 years, cost per beneficiary in the public programs have tracked cost per beneficiary in the rest of the health sector. It seems implausible to me that in the future, those lines, after living a somewhat unhappy but nonetheless some form of coexistence, will get ripped apart in the future. So changes that are narrowly tailored just to the programs of Medicare and Medicaid and don't engender overall healthcare systemic changes are unlikely to be sustainable without creating massive access problems. I usually get to this part in the talk and say, okay, it all sounds very depressing. This is the biggest problem. We're underinvesting in figuring out ways of dealing with it. It's really complicated because you can't just think about it within the four corners of the programs themselves. But before I get all depressed about that, I then stop and realize that there is, I think, an amazing opportunity embedded in the central long-term fiscal challenge facing the nation to take cost out of the system without harming health. And that opportunity, if you think about it, is truly remarkable. There is a wide variety of evidence, in my view, that the United States is either on the flat part or the downward sloping part of the medical effectiveness curve. That is, over some range of healthcare spending, there are improvements in health that are associated with it. But at the margin, we are either at the flat part or the downward sloping part of that curve. What is the evidence for that? I think there's a whole variety of evidence, but perhaps the most compelling, and this usually works better in color, so I apologize for the black and white, but the next chart shows you the very substantial variation in healthcare spending per beneficiary across different parts of the United States for reasons that cannot be explained by the underlying riskiness of the patients, that can't be explained by the relative wage rates and costs of building hospitals, et cetera, in different parts of the country, that can't be explained by all sorts of other factors that people have thrown out there. A couple of weeks ago, someone came up to me and said that looks remarkably correlated with cloud cover on rainy days across. So anyway, people up at Dartmouth have spent their entire careers trying to explain that variation. At most, they can reduce the variation by perhaps a quarter, suggesting very substantial variation remains. And that furthermore, the kicker is that the higher spending regions don't generate better health outcomes than the lower spending regions. If you took the highest spending regions, moving to the lowest spending regions in terms of spending levels, the Dartmouth analysts suggest that there'd be no diminution in average health, and that The reduction in health spending would be on the order of 30% or so. Even within the public programs themselves, Medicare and Medicaid, let alone overall health spending, a 30% reduction, just to sort of calibrate it, is as large as the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation, over which there is so much public debate. To try to get at what might be driving that differential or that variation, and therefore what might help to narrow it or to kind of help to start identify pathways to capturing that opportunity that I mentioned, I think this next chart is informative, the one that kind of different people look at it and they start to look at, try to see if they see animals or different shapes. But the basic point here is, this is basically discharge ratios, but think about it as the cost of surgery. This is just for surgery itself. And the shorter and fatter the clumping, the more, the less variation there is across the United States. The longer and thinner the variation, the more variation there is across the United States. Now here's the thing, if you fracture your hip, I'm sure there are doctors and medical professionals in the room, if you fracture your hip, you're gonna go in for surgery. There's not a lot of variation across the United States in the cost of that surgery because there's not a lot of ambiguity about what should happen. Back surgery or other cases where there's a lot more ambiguity, there's a lot more variation. And here's what I think is the most interesting part of this. If you look at the follow-on cost of surgery, not the surgery cost itself, but the follow-up cost, no one can currently tell you whether you're supposed to go see a doctor 4 times a month after that hip fracture surgery, 2 times a month. Are you supposed to do physical therapy or not? Are you supposed to get an MRI or not? There's all sorts of ambiguity about what should happen post-surgery, even in the hip fracture case. And guess what? There's a lot of variation in the post-surgical costs for those suffering from a hip fracture. In other words, in the face of the a lack of evidence about what works and what doesn't or about what should happen, my view is that doctor norms in different parts of the country take hold. So in some parts of the country, the norm is that you go see a doctor 5 times a month following hip fracture surgery, and in other parts, 2 times a month. Because those norms develop not on the basis of medical evidence but on some other basis, they don't produce improvements in health outcomes, and we get a lot of variation across the United States precisely in those areas where it's less clear what should happen. The Institute of Medicine has suggested only perhaps a quarter of healthcare costs arise in the sort of hip fracture surgery case where it's clear, where there's some evidence that it's clear what should happen, basically. The vast majority is arising more in the sort of follow-up cost kind of scenario where no one has any idea whether the 6th visit or the 7th visit per month has any marginal benefit. That raises the obvious potential for expanding the share of healthcare costs upon which there is some evidence, and then creating financial incentives and creating the payment system to correspond to the evidence that results on what works and what doesn't. I see that we have a representative from the National Institute from NICE in the UK, which I think is a great acronym for this kind of activity. And that is perhaps the paragon of this type of research done internationally. And there is a lot that we can learn here in the United States about how to undertake this kind of research. But I think there is widespread agreement that more of it is essential. And I would add to that, that regardless of how we structure an entity or entities to undertake that kind of research, and I would note here that the entity or entities that undertakes this kind of research will almost necessarily have to rely upon non-randomized evidence to some degree. That is, the thought that we will go from 25% of healthcare costs up to 90% of healthcare costs having some evidence associated with it is implausible to me based just on randomized control trials. So necessarily, the medical profession will have to rely on the sorts of messy panel data econometric techniques that economists have long struggled with, which I find ironic because a good part of the economics profession is now yearning for more randomized experiments, and there's a lot of activity surrounding that, just when the medical profession, I think, is going to have to move in the opposite direction and suffer from all of the frustration that statisticians and econometricians have dealt with over the past several decades, and even longer than that. In that kind of setting, a broader base of electronic health records could be enormously beneficial by providing basically that panel data set from which a comparative effectiveness entity or entities could evaluate various different kinds of treatments, technologies, and interventions. So one of the biggest returns to a health information technology backbone in the United States may not be its direct effect on spending or on healthcare delivery, but its indirect effect by feeding information to folks who can undertake analysis on what works and what doesn't. The second point I would note is basically in healthcare, to a first approximation, we get what we provide financial incentives for. So we get a lot of high-end technology because we provide strong incentives for that. We don't get a lot of preventative medicine in the United States because we don't provide strong financial incentives for that. If you are going to drive change towards higher value healthcare, you need to change the financial incentives facing providers towards providing that higher value healthcare. So just setting up a comparative effectiveness entity or entities, just undertaking this kind of research by itself will not produce either budgetary or overall healthcare savings to a large degree. However, if we were to undertake aggressively this kind of research, perhaps through a new entity or entities, which I could talk more about during the question and answer period, and if it were to conduct a very substantial amount of such research, expanding the share of healthcare costs up from 25% to some much larger number, and if we were to change, in particular, Medicare's payment system to provide financial incentives for higher value care, I think it is entirely plausible that over the long term there would be a very substantial reduction in healthcare spending, including through Medicare, that results. There are very few things that this director of the Congressional Budget Office can say offer that kind of potential. And while there are many intervening steps that are involved in getting from here to there, there are a few things that hold that kind of potential. And I would just close by again reminding ourselves about the impact and magnitude of what we're talking about. There is not a single factor that is anywhere close to determining how well, to the extent that you are all U.S. citizens, so I'll exempt our friends from the U.K. from this, that will determine the fiscal burden imposed on your children and grandchildren in the United States than whether healthcare costs grow 2.5 percentage points faster than income per capita, or 1 percentage point faster than income per capita, or 0.5 percentage points faster than income per capita over the next 40 to 50 to 60 years. Comparative effectiveness research and tying that to the financial incentives facing providers offers the potential for some combination of a significant reduction in cost and or a significant increase in value. And I would just close by saying that if we're going to wind up spending 20% of GDP on Medicare and Medicaid in 2050, I would sure hope that we would be getting as much value from it as possible. So this is not just about bending that curve, although I think it is about that also. It's also about whatever curve we wind up being on, getting as much benefit in terms of health as possible from that level of spending. Thank you.
Hopefully, oh boy, everyone can hear me. Well, thank you very much. I thought that was a fantastic start. I already see some questions out there, and I'm sure there'll be plenty, especially on your closing point. I wanted to just kick off the Q&A with the taking one step back to a subject that came up in the last panel discussion, and I think it was Sean Tunis who said there's a public interest in innovation, and that line kind of struck me because a lot of the debate focuses on containing costs. And I think most people in this room would agree with, as a premise, and I'll phrase it differently, that innovation is in some sense inherently cost effective. Maybe an individual invention is not, but in some sense the advance of technology ultimately pays off. I wonder first, as a card-carrying economist, if you agree with that as a premise, and second, whether that's ever something that could be scored in the context of legislation.
I think one of the things that we need to pay careful attention to, and I'm glad that you raised this this point. To the extent that we do move down this path, and I would be thinking that it is more likely than not that we as a nation will move down this path, and I could come back to why I think that in a moment, it is very important to pay attention to not just the static effect, that is the sort of point in time effect on spending and health outcomes, but also the incentives for innovation. I do not think that we should take it as a article of faith that all innovation is cost effective in terms of the health benefit outcomes that it generates per cost of budgetary or other cost measure. But it is certainly the case that, again, returning to that concept of the medical effectiveness curve, that over a broad range of spending, additional healthcare spending, including especially on new technology, has generated health benefits. I think the question is whether we can do a better job of, at the margin, filtering out or providing incentives for the new technologies that are more effective and weaker incentives for the new technologies that are less effective. I don't know what the marginal medical benefit of the 10 millionth MRI scan is in the United States. For the first 10, I would imagine that the medical benefits are very, very, very substantial. I think the question is, we are underinvesting in figuring out which new technologies and which new treatments are worth it and which aren't. And I think the reason is, I could talk more about this, but there is no, you would think that perhaps insurance firms in the current structure would be where the incentives to undertake this kind of research would rest. But we have a fundamentally employer-based system in the United States. Insurance firms, therefore, don't have either the data because people are turning over or the incentive because people are turning over to undertake this research as aggressively as the public interest would suggest. So take for granted that technological innovation in the health sector has, on average, produced quite significant health benefits. But also remember that it is not, that average doesn't mean that at the margin we're getting our money's worth on a whole variety of technologies. And again, I would suggest that the regional variation evidence suggests we're doing a lot of things at the margin that are not generating health benefits.
Thanks. I'll ask you one other question that you probably can't answer, which is okay. There is legislation pending now, and I guess Senator Box's bill in the Senate would be the most prominent example. Has CBO looked at some of those proposals yet, and have you come up with any magic numbers on whether there are savings associated with those comparative effectiveness ideas?
CBO is going to be doing a lot of work, and we are doing a lot of work on comparative effectiveness activities, including how a comparative effectiveness entity could be organized. And I would just go back to saying the official budget scoring process is usually focused on 5 or 10 years. It will take time to get a comparative effectiveness entity or entities, however organized and however financed, up and running. It will take time for the research to be undertaken that would be necessary. And it would also take time to start changing, for example, the Medicare system towards what Mark McClellan has called a fee-for-value system rather than a fee-for-service system, all of which start to push you well outside that 10-year window when you start to think about impacts. But if we were to aggressively pursue that kind of activity, and if we were aggressively to tie financial incentives towards evidence on what worked and what didn't, I do believe that there would be a significant impact in terms of cost savings over the long term, both for the federal budget and for the economy as a whole, from more cost-effective healthcare.
John Gladden.
Peter, it's John Gladden with Avalere. The implicit assumption in your juxtaposition of the excess cost with the Dartmouth data suggests that the excess cost values in the low utilization regions and in the more densely compacted procedures is somehow less than the excess cost in the high spending regions and the widely dispersed. That is, Miami costs a lot, but is the growth rate in Miami faster or slower than the growth rate in New Hampshire? So is the idea of bringing evidence to bear necessarily going to drive the cost growth rate down, or is it just going to take costs out of the system to be replaced by new costs that are growing at the old rate?
It's a very good question. I don't think we know, but I think there's the potential for a financing system that's based on value rather than quantity to affect both the level and the growth rate. I think it's clearer in terms of the level of cost, but there is at least the potential for it to also affect the growth rate. The mechanism whereby it would affect the growth rate is that to the extent that much of the growth rate is tied to the introduction of new technologies that may or may not be, you know, pass some sort of is it worth it test, one can imagine worlds. It's a difficult question to answer. I will just, again, come back to that. And we have spent a fair amount of time discussing that internally at CBO. I do think there's less evidence on it, but there is the potential for it to affect the growth rate through basically the rate of technological adoption over time.
So a lot of people in the room will groan as I rise to the defense of the controlled trial.
Can I just make clear? I wasn't calling for its abolition. I just don't think. I don't think you can.
And I think
I don't think you can deduct enough of them.
There's probably a reason why the economists are, you know, running away from the the models towards
Indeed.
The controlled studies. But here's the only reason I raise this point really is that I personally think, and I'll be interested in how you respond, that if you had a $3 billion comparative effectiveness center, you ought to spend $2 billion of it on prospective comparative studies. And the reason I derive that is, and I'm making that up, of course, but in sort of living in the weeds of trying to make reimbursement decisions at Medicare using comparative effectiveness information, what we were always hung up on was the best information we had was usually from poorly designed observational studies. And as one example, and again, people have heard it lots of times from me, we spend $20 billion a year on wound healing interventions, a big chunk of that on various Medicare interventions. And the problem with wound care is there's very few prospective comparative studies. And the people who have reviewed the studies always say that the observational studies simply can't be adjusted for baseline differences in patient populations. So, I would just say, to have this comparative effectiveness discussion and to imply that we ought not to be thinking seriously about spending most of the money on high-quality prospective studies might not generate the kind of savings you're hoping for.
So let me say a couple things. And as one of the economists who was very active in moving towards randomized experiments, I won't go through all the battle wounds associated with that, but I am very much aware of the shortcomings in observational studies or econometric analysis of panel data, because you can't possibly control for everything that you need to control for. That having been said, I do think that in general, observational studies based on high quality data and based on sufficiently large data sets are better than nothing. And I don't think it's plausible that even your $2 billion will get you close to enough, even remotely close to upping the share of healthcare costs upon which there is any evidence at all. And I would rather have observational evidence than nothing. That's the first observation. The second observation is I do think that the amount of time it takes to conduct a randomized trial, evaluate its results, may in some situations impede or be less effective or less beneficial than the type of rapid learning that could be possible from an electronic health record system that's tied to some analytical capability. And there has been a lot of discussion about whether a much broader health information technology backbone could allow faster analysis of interventions, of adverse effects, et cetera, that would have health benefits. That's the kind of thing that's very hard to get from a randomized trial by design. All of which is to say, I think we need tiers of I would imagine, just like in economics, I think there should be tiers of evidence, with the randomized trial being at the top of it, being the gold standard, and I think it seems to me implausible that it won't remain the gold standard. It is the gold standard. But that for a variety of things, we're going to need sort of lesser quality evidence, which does have some benefits. It has benefits of timeliness. It also has benefits of, it's hard to design a randomized trial where you capture all of the real world noise that occurs in a physician's office or in a nurse practitioner's interventions. And observational data are messy, but they often pick up that noise imperfectly, but more than you get in a pure randomized trial. So I want to make it very clear that nothing that I said should in any way impugn the randomized trial as being, you know, the gold standard. I believe it is. It's just a sort of practicality question of how much it would cost and how long it would take to do randomized trials on everything that upon which I think the evidence is needed.
First of all, I just wanted to say that it is absolutely invigorating and refreshing to know that someone in your position is fully awake at the wheel and helping to look, you know, at the basic, you know, deepest, one of the deepest problems we have as a society is trying to come to grips with these trends. So I just want to thank you for your engagement and reaching out on this topic. I heard you say when you were talking earlier, you spent some time talking about the excess doctor's visits and other parts of variation that can drive costs. But then later you also talked about whether certain technologies might be worth it. Now, whether it's worth it triggers a lot of deep-seated responses from patients, from physicians. And I just wanted to pose for you the question of whether when you talk about that facet of comparative effectiveness and what it can bring us in terms of improved value, do you think that we can get to that question without looking at costs and cost effectiveness explicitly as part of what comparative effectiveness would do? I mean, I can imagine, as many of us can, that there are innovations, technologies that might offer improved convenience, minor improvements in terms of toxicity, or even potentially other kinds of outcomes at 10 times the price, 20 times the price. Is that what you mean by, is it worth it? Are we going to be looking at that? Should we?
Let me say two things. First, I think it's hard to imagine changes to payment systems that don't take cost into account, at least to some degree or in some way. So that's the first observation. The second observation is, it's hard for me to imagine in the United States changes to the payment system, for example, within Medicare, that are sort of dichotomous. We pay for this and we don't pay for that, as opposed to scales. You know, we'll reimburse at X rate for the highest tier evidence kinds of procedures, technologies, et cetera, and then lower tiers for things upon which there's less evidence. Or similarly, that if you've got a large enough group to make this make sense, that if the evidence suggests that you should be seeing patients four times a month instead of six times a month, you know, if 10% of your patients, because you know better and you know their individual characteristics, you're seeing them six times a month, that's fine and that will be fully compensated. But if you're seeing 90% of your patients six times a month, that's probably more about you than your patients. So thinking about starting to figure out ways in which physician autonomy can be preserved, but that evidence can be brought to bear to influence some of the choices that physicians are making, at least on average. I mean, returning to that example, I actually would not want, even if we had like a benevolent dictator kind of model, I would not want evidence based on large averages to govern exactly and in all cases what a doctor in the United States prescribes or does with a particular patient. You want to allow the physician and allow the medical system to reflect the variety of individual characteristics that exist. But on the other hand, we currently have a system where there's sort of too little information being brought to bear, and the pendulum needs to shift a little bit more in the other direction, I would imagine. And returning to your question, I, w- I, again, can't imagine a world in which you help to bend that curve over the long term, in which cost is not at least part of the equation. And my understanding, based on reading and discussions I've had, is that in the UK, having that be clearly part of the mandate or part of what NICE is supposed to do has been crucially important to their activities.
To take this conversation one step further, given that you have this, you're awake at the wheel and you have this need to deal with the trend line, what advice, if there is an issue created, what advice and what your role might CBO play in setting priorities? Because, at least from my observation, it seems sometimes that the cost effectiveness criteria comes in, let's say, for pharmaceuticals or devices, especially pharmaceuticals, where there just has to be a lot of information, rather than necessarily on those procedures or other activities that might really affect the overall cost trend line. So I imagine you guys have looked at that, and if you could engage in setting priorities, where do you think you get the most bang for the research buck from changing those trend lines?
Well, let me say a couple things first. I should quickly say, CBO will not be in a position to undertake, a detailed level of research. Our entire staff is 235 people. I already mentioned under 15% of them work on health. You can start to do the math and see the inherent limitations on what we do. And furthermore, we don't make recommendations anyway. It's for policymakers to decide exactly what the priorities would be in that kind of setting. What we can do is help to lay out options for organizing this kind of entity and the factors that policymakers would presumably want to think about in setting the priorities for that kind of organization, to the extent it's got some governmental linkage, and I would imagine that it would have at least some. And there are a whole variety of things. We're going to, rather than sort of going through them all now, we will be issuing reports and public documents that sort of talk more expansively about some of those factors this year, this calendar year. So you'll see more from CBO on that topic. I would just note one aside on evidence, and you raise pharmaceuticals. There's a whole variety of things upon which CBO has to make decisions all the time, and in which just sort of illustrating the lack of evidence on crucial topics. I'll give you one example from the past month. There were two new NBER studies out, I don't want to say the past month, past 2 or 3 months, both of which examine the effect of pharmaceutical take-up, that is, taking prescription drugs, on inpatient hospitalization rates. One of which, John Gruber's paper, finds a significant effect that basically there's a substitution between higher prescription drug spending and lower inpatient costs, and another of which finds no effect. That is an example of a specific question upon which entities like CBO are desperately in need of more evidence, and I am often faced, and since I think there may be people in the room who can help on this, I will just make this plea. I'm often presented with people who say, oh, we know that. Here's what our experience has been. And then I say, oh, that's great. Can you send me the data? And then I never hear from them. So to the extent that any of you believe that prescription drug spending does or does not affect inpatient hospitalization costs, and to the extent you actually have hard data on it, send it to us.
You've mentioned electronic health records a couple of times in your discussion, and I mentioned this morning. Obviously, if we want decisions in medicine based on evidence, we need more evidence, and that comes from data.
Right.
But as you know, the rate of adoption for EHRs in this country is fairly low, 17% to 24%, and when you look at the safety net, it's even lower. There are a number of this administration so far has seemed reluctant to try to find ways to fund physician purchases of EMRs. There are a number of proposals in Congress, including Adolphus Towns, who's looking at, again, specifically how to ensure that EMRs are deployed into the communities where costs are high and healthcare, chronic disease is high, but the margins are low, and so there's not a lot of extra money around for a $50,000 or $75,000 investment. One of the big obstacles it always comes down to how CBO looks at the investment in electronic health records, that you, under whatever rules you operate under, cannot score as a savings cost avoidance. And I'm wondering if you could touch upon that and what you're doing to sort of overcome your own internal barriers so that we can free up some money.
Okay. You are not the only one who has asked me this question. I was at a finance committee hearing a few weeks ago, and Senator Grassley turned to me and said, "You realize you've become God." I think on health information technology, two things are worth noting. First, it is not the case that we can't score cost avoidance. We have there's a sort of baseline of health spending that against which we evaluate legislative changes, and to the extent that we think that a legislative intervention, a policy change, would reduce spending compared to that projection, we will score those savings. So theoretically, there are savings that could be had. Quickly note, however, I'm spending a lot of time internally reviewing the work that we have done and the work that others have done on health information technology, and I don't think, based on what I've seen so far, that the evidence of direct savings within a 5 or 10 year budget window is as compelling as many media and other discussions suggest, in part because there are questions about the rate of at which adoption will expand even in the absence of a policy change. In other words, if we move from the number I have in my head is 20%, that's in the middle of your range. If over time that's going to increase, what will the legislative change do to the rate of adoption, and then what's the marginal impact from that? A lot of the studies have just said if there is more health information technology, here's what the impact would be. But to the extent that some or all of that would have occurred anyway, we can't score the savings. So short answer to your question is, theoretically, it is possible for there to be savings associated with health information technology investments. CBO previously has said that the evidence for those kinds of savings, at least within a 5 or 10 year window, is not overwhelming. We are reviewing that evidence, and that is another topic upon which, to the extent people have specific data, I would welcome it, because we are always looking for updated information. And then finally, I would say, again, like comparative effectiveness, outside the 5 or 10 year window, investments in health information technology may pay off not just directly in terms of what they would do by themselves, but perhaps more importantly in terms of providing the data for comparative effectiveness research, as you've noted.
Ladies and gentlemen, we just have time for one more question. So,
okay. Thank you. I want to go back to the discussion of the gold standard and suggest that we had this a little bit of discussion in our previous session, that there's something in between the placebo-controlled, randomized, etc., gold standard and econometric methods, and that is designs like adaptive designs, conditional probabilities that may take fewer patients, be done quicker, and it is a whole range of activities that if the FDA got funding from the federal government as opposed to only from industry, or it's becoming more and more so from industry, that some of these methodologies could be explored a little more. And does the Congressional Budget Office have anything to say about that issue?
What I would just say is that I think there are a whole variety. I won't comment on the structure of FDA payments. Obviously, FDA reauthorization is up this year, and we will be commenting on that throughout the year at the appropriate time. On the specific design of different types of analytical studies, I guess what I would say is economists actually have struggled with what you do in the absence of a randomized trial at a lot of with a lot of sweat and a lot of length, and I don't think there's a perfect answer, but there have been a wide variety of interventions and improvements that were made. The one thing I would say about that is I go back to something that was said a long time ago, but that I think is still true, which is, this is not a direct answer to your question, but fancier and fancier statistical and econometric techniques at the margin, I think, are less valuable than having more data. That is to say, in many settings, expanding out the set of data that you have is more valuable than playing with the latest econometric intervention based on very, very noisy data to start with. And I think in both economics and in health, we have underinvested in obtaining the raw data with which one can conduct various kinds of analyses of various types. And I guess I would leave it at that. And I want to thank you all for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. That was a fantastic and very stimulating discussion. And I think the luncheon session is adjourned. And Tanisha, when does the conference resume? As soon as possible, so.